My next speaker, Brother Stephen Jones. Tell you a little bit about him. He has his PhD in physics, mathematics, electronics minor from Vanderbilt University in 1978, retaining tuition scholarship and a research fellowship. He has his postdoctoral research conducted at Cornell University and the Los Alamos Mason Physics Facility. He has been awarded the David O. McKay Scholarship at Brigham Young University. He has been on a mission to France, Belgium. He's been a counselor in two bishoprics. He's been on the State High Council, the Young Men's President, and the Bishop. He has written over 50 peer-reviewed scientific publications, including in Scientific American, Nature three times, and Physical Review Letters. And I'm happy to present Stephen Jones to you.
Tim is setting up the camera there. I'm going to set up my computer. That didn't work. Okay. Now let's see if this is going to fly. It was just over 2 years ago in this very room that I had my real introduction to 9/11 as being something other than Al-Qaeda and the Muslims did it, and we have to go get them now. The occasion was a talk by Sarah Monet, and Sarah, during her remarks, some of you know Sarah. Okay, I can't turn up that. I can't turn it up, but I can maybe hug it a little bit. Sarah, in her remarks, she paused and she said, "Now, if you think that those towers came down just because they were hit by planes, you have some major surprises ahead of you." And the audience broke into applause, or about half the audience, and I was of the half that was looking around thinking, "Well, what in the world is she talking about?" Now, I had had some nudges from friends, one of whom is here tonight, to look at the events, I see, of 9/11 scientifically with a critical eye, as I've been trained as a scientist. And after Sarah's talk, I did. I was not teaching that spring, and so this is in 2005. So I got online and started looking. I saw for the first time the collapse of World Trade Center 7, which is being shown behind me here on the screen. This is a 47-story skyscraper. I'm going to start my timer because I've got a certain time here to hold to. 47-story skyscraper in downtown Manhattan. I'll show you its location. It's part of the World Trade Center complex. Was not hit by a jet, and yet at 5:20 in the afternoon it came down, as you can see. It comes straight down very rapidly, completely collapses, never hit by a jet. Is that clear? Now, I'd like to know, how many of you is this the first time that you've seen Building 7 collapse? Let me just see. Okay, there's quite a few. Last weekend, I was in Vancouver, Canada, speaking about 9/11 at a conference there, and I think there were just two in the audience who had not seen Building 7 collapse. So that's quite a number. If this is your first introduction, I hope you will take a closer look here with me tonight. And I'll show you some places where you can get some more information in addition. I shifted my talk around a little bit as we were going along here. I decided I would start with President Packer commenting at a devotional at BYU earlier this year in January. And let me just read a little bit from President Packer to set the stage. Moroni warned us that the secret combinations begun by Gadianton quoting now from the Book of Mormon, are head among all people. Wherefore, O ye Gentiles. Now at this point, President Packer pauses and he interjects his own comment. And the term Gentile in that place in the Book of Mormon refers to us in our generation. Speaking to you now, in other words, okay. It is wisdom in God that these things should be shown unto you, that thereby ye may repent of your sins, and suffer not that these murderous combinations shall get above you. Wherefore the Lord commandeth you. This is not a suggestion, you know. And I remember President Benson saying, it sounds like Moroni here is a little bit worried that we won't catch on, you know. So, a commandment, when you shall see these things come among you, that you shall awake to a sense of your awful situation. Of course, this is the basis of the title of Jack Manette's book. Because of this secret combination which shall be among you. Not maybe, not, you know, maybe, possibly. No, it shall be among you. He went on, I'm just quoting obviously parts of President Packer's talk. You who are young will see many things that will try your courage and test your faith. All of the mocking does not come from outside of the church. Let me say that again. I'm quoting President Packer. All of the mocking does not come from outside of the church. Be careful that you do not fall into the category of mocking. The Lord promised, if you are prepared, you shall not fear. I'm glad that my calling and my ward now is preparedness, emergency preparedness committee, because, you know, it's just what I'm trying to encourage. You know, I talk to a lot of people who are not Latter-day Saints about year supply and about a three-month rotating food supply. I hope you've heard about that. It's in the pamphlet now that was announced at the last general conference. I'll talk more about that at the end, in case you missed that, three-month rotating food supply. I talked to people about that, and I'll tell you, there's a lot of non-LDS, good people, who are very interested in preparing, getting their food storage, so they don't have to worry so much anyway, and so that they're ready. And this is the key. If you are prepared, the Lord said, you shall not fear. Now, finishing up by Elder Packer last January at BYU. You live in an interesting generation where trials will be constant in your life. Learn to follow the promptings of the Holy Ghost. That's what Joel mentioned as well. This is the key to getting through this interesting time period, looking forward to the second coming of Christ. And it comes to mind the Book of Mormon in those decades before the coming of Christ. President Benson and others pointed out, we'll see many parallels to our day. I hope you can see them. The Gadiant robbers, Helaman 6 and 7, right on through, actually, till 3 Nephi 11. Raising children in a world that is turned upside down. You will face many great and tumultuous and difficult things in your life. But then, he says, you will also enjoy great inspiration and joy in your life. And that's the context I approach this. As we work together, as we're prepared, we can, and follow the promptings of the Holy Ghost, we can have that inspiration and find joy, even in difficult times. Think of what's at the end of the tunnel here. Right, okay. I'll see you in Missouri, if I don't see you in Missouri. we're on a path of truth here tonight. And the following, what follows truth is justice. Hopefully, there will be justice ultimately, if not in this life, and peace depends on truth. Patrick Henry put it this way in a similar period in the America's history in many ways, 1775. We are apt to shut our eyes against a painful truth. But is this the part of wise men engaged in a great and arduous struggle for liberty? For my part, and I hope this will be your part, whatever anguish of spirit it might cost, I am willing to know the whole truth and to know it now. And the greatest of all, in my opinion, said, who lived on this earth, the truth shall make you free. All right, so that's the goal. Time is passing very quickly. don't look Carol at the time. The first of the items I want to bring to your attention is we look at the events of 9/11 scientifically is the complete collapse. Fortunately, I already showed you the collapse of Building 7. It's on the right. On the left, you see an inferno that engulfed a high-rise in Madrid, Spain. The building, as you see, did not collapse. In fact, there are zero examples of high-rise buildings collapsing due to fire. This building also had concrete in it. The World Trade Center towers and Building 7 were steel frame buildings, strictly. But I show this Madrid building so you can see the inferno that was there. Look at Building 7. Do you see a tremendous inferno there? There were some random fires in the building. We'll talk more about that. But notice that this building did not collapse. After the fire was out, it was still standing. That's what has happened in every other case of high-rise buildings like this, steel frame buildings. A piece of it, though, did slough off. So you'd say there was a partial collapse, not a complete collapse of the building. And it also we find that the Building 7 falls at nearly free fall speed, the roof, as it begins its steady decline. So here we see a photo of World Trade Center 7. Let me see if I can get that on the screen for you. There, that's just about right. On the afternoon of 9/11, so you see, looking now from the rubble where the World Trade Center building stood, look, and here's Building 7 standing in the afternoon. It fell 7 hours after the towers had collapsed. The distance from the nearest tower, which is the North Tower, to the Building 7 is about 100 meters, 100 yards, about a football field length away across the street. And now, as you can see, the collapse is complete. On the right, we have a controlled demolition. I suppose all of us have seen controlled demolitions. The goal of a controlled demolition in general is to bring that building straight down onto its footprint, precisely what happened with Building 7. Of course, that trick is accomplished in controlled demolition using explosives to get material out of the way so that the roof can fall down and fall very rapidly. The 9/11 Commission report, supposedly a complete discussion of events of 9/11, failed to even mention the collapse of Building 7. The FEMA report was the first official report on these collapses. Stated, our best hypothesis, which is fire with some damage for Building 7, has only a low probability of occurrence. Let's give them credit for honesty there. We've been joined in this worldwide truth movement now, 9/11 truth movement, by a number of people, including some structural professors in Switzerland at ETH, which is equivalent roughly of our MIT. In my opinion, says Hugo Bachmann, WTC-7 was with the highest probability brought down by controlled demolition done by experts. People were excluded that day. You don't have Al-Qaeda agents running in and setting explosives to bring the building down on 9/11. George Schneider, this is in a newspaper over in Europe, another professor emeritus, structural analysis, said World Trade Center 7 was with the great probability brought down by explosives. There are now over 140 architects and engineers in the group called Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. In the group that I'm a member of, there are over 440 scholars now, scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice. STJ911.org. And basically, if you are willing to read, not just looking at videos is fine, if you're willing to read the articles in the Journal of 9/11 Studies, which I'll talk about more, then we invite you to join. So let me put that up there again. STJ911.org. and help spread the word about 9/11. I want to quote something that just came out, Loose Change. Many of you have seen this DVD. It's by some young men who put together a number of evidences regarding 9/11. And they recently released from their movie, they're planning a regular movie for theaters that should be out hopefully towards the end of this year. Quoting from a security guard, an interview, he was asked to go into Building 7 in the morning. Now, this is after the first tower had been hit, but before the second tower was hit. He was asked to go in and escort someone up to the 23rd floor, which they did. When they got up there, the place was evacuated, and so they started going down. And now, quoting from this security guard, "We subsequently went to the stairwell and were going down the stairs. When we reached the sixth floor, the landing we were standing on gave way. There was an explosion, and the landing gave way. I was left there hanging. I had to climb back up, and now had to walk back up to the eighth floor." And they were able, from the eighth floor, to find another way out. So there was an explosion, and obviously very damaging, because their stairway was destroyed below them. Now this is interesting because NIST, National Institute of Standards and Technology, which was tasked to explain the collapse of these World Trade Center buildings, when it gets to World Trade Center 7, their report is long overdue. And just today, now let me back up, it was supposed to be out December of last year, then they said spring of this year. Well, it's passed. And so just today, NIST had a press release saying, well, they plan to have it out by the end of this year now. Well, it's long overdue. Anyway, they subcontracted to a company in Albuquerque, ARA, to analyze the collapse of Building 7. And here's the restrictions that they put in this solicitation. NIST asked them to create detailed floor analyses to determine likely modes of failure for floors 8 to 46 due to failure of one or more supporting columns in World Trade Center 7. Now, why would they restrict them, you know, floor 8 and above? Well, we just read this fellow, as he's coming down, the explosion was below him. Below, when they got back to floor 8, they were okay. They could find another way out. Aha. They also comment today, of course I added this today, NIST has found no evidence of a blast or controlled demolition event. Well, evidently that may be true if you stop yourself above floor 8. As a scientist, I want to know, well, what happens below floor 8? And we're finding out. Unfortunately, they're not looking at the whole picture, are they, when they limit that view from floors 8 to 46. Already gives us a pause. Furthermore, NIST, despite Freedom of Information Act requests, they've refused to release the videos and photos that they have, which they acquired from taxpayers at taxpayer expense, you know, mostly from taxpayers, people taking videos. They refused to release any photos of Building 7. We would like to get that released. So if that's something we can work toward, I would recommend that we do that. Let's see, I'll skip that. Let's see. You'll have to read about some of this by going to the Journal of 9/11 Studies. I will point out just a couple of things. There was in this building a secret CIA office, also offices of the Department of Defense. So this is a highly secure building. It's not one that terrorists could just run into and set explosives. The owner slash leaseholder of the World Trade Center buildings insured these buildings, the World Trade Center, against terrorist attack 6 weeks, just about 6 weeks before 9/11, before the terrorist attack. And the payout in insurance was about $4.6 billion. We could say more about that, but you'll have to read some of this, as I say, because you're scholars, right? And so as you read. The World Trade Center towers, moving along to those, they're very solidly constructed, as you might imagine, with 47 core columns. Here are the core columns up close, and 240 perimeter columns. These are not hollow tubes, as I have heard argued from structural engineers who should know better. We now have the release of the architectural plans, by the way. That came out just earlier this year. Quick story on that, a professor in Colorado sent them to me. He'd worked with the insurance companies. And, oh, thank you very much, Jack. It gave me a little more time. Appreciate it. I'll give you 10 minutes sometime, maybe. Anyway, this professor in Colorado had worked with the insurance companies, during this discussion, the trials, actually, to see how much would be paid out to Mr. Silverstein and company. And so he had access to these architectural plans. He sent them to me on a disc, and he said, I'd like these to be made public, but not my name to be made public. So they are now public. And, we're glad to help get that information out. So there's no question, these are not hollow tubes. We have the detailed plans. I put a stove here to remind you, this is steel, here's structural steel. And I have a wood-burning stove. And I'm not worried about it melting on me or collapsing either. Steel melts at 1538 centigrade, plus or minus a little, depending on what alloys you use. And fires reach a maximum temperature of about 1100 centigrade. And this NIST report included that. They say there's no way this melted. No, that's not the problem. We look at conservation momentum in analyzing the collapse of these buildings. Again, just like the World Trade Center 7, the collapse is too rapid unless there are explosives moving the material out of the way. This diagram is from a paper by Dr. Leggy in the Journal of 911studies.com. And his argument is a rather easy one to understand. You take the upper block of 16 floors, so just below where the planes went in, and you say, okay, we'll give it to NIST. We'll let it start to collapse, okay? Somehow, all those 287 columns give way more or less simultaneous, so the thing starts to move down, this upper block. Okay, we'll grant that, even though we have our doubts about that, too. But now what happens? See? The rest of the building is there. It is not designed to give up when something moves. It's designed to stand. In fact, it's designed to withstand hurricane force winds and also, by the way, a collision of a 707. That was designed, Boeing 707, back in the days when these were designed and then built. So the question he arises is, which is going to fall faster, the block that falls in air or the block that has approximately 300,000 tons of concrete and steel beams, 287 support columns, in the way? This is not a trick question. You see, obviously, the one falling in air should fall faster. But in fact, what's observed is the roof falls at nearly free fall speed, as if there's nothing in the way. Now, how do you do that? We've all experienced conservation momentum, which is when you're driving in your car and you hit something, you slow down. Okay. Now, when you hit 300,000 tons of steel and concrete, by George, you're going to slow down, the way down. And Professor Cutler, are you here tonight, Ken, by any chance, did a paper looking at how long it would take for the towers to collapse, and he's getting upwards of 30 seconds. Well, they collapsed in about 12, plus or minus 2 or 3 seconds, you see. Way too fast. Now, how do you do the trick, then, to get them collapsed so fast? You move material out of the way. Gordon Ross also writes about this. Depending on the safety factor that was present in the buildings, they're designed to stand not just a factor of one, but 2 or 3 times, that like that, the weight. Anyway, they might not have collapsed at all. They might not have collapsed at all, is the argument. If you look at conservation of energy and momentum, read the paper by Gordon Ross on that one. If we look at the data, they completely collapse. Now, looking at the towers after the collapse, the cores are gone. This is not a pancake collapse. On the right, you see an actual pancake collapse. due to an earthquake in Asia where you have the floors stacked up. This is not the case with the towers, you know. Instead, they were pulverized. How do you do that without explosives? See? It's not taking a PhD to figure this out. Now, how does NIST handle this problem? How does NIST handle this problem where all the data goes against the official story of, you know, fires caused, and then gravity, the thing just gives up and straight down in 12 seconds. You know, how do they do? Here's the trick that they use. They take you and they put this in a report with like 10,000 pages of report. They take you only to the point where the towers are poised for collapse. Their term. Quote, poised for collapse. In other words, they ignore the speed of collapse, the completeness of the collapse, the squibs, the expulsions of air and debris, and so on. All these signs that we recognize. Now, if you're looking at a controlled demolition, before it goes off, can you tell it's going to go off, that there are explosives in there? Well, unless you know that there, you couldn't. But when it goes, you can tell, because it goes straight down completely and very fast. That's just what happened. It has all the characteristics of controlled demolition. Folks, this is not rocket science. And there are, as I say, structural engineers joining it. Now, Bazant just came out with a paper, and his few joined him. They say this upper block, I'm going to have to go a little faster, must remain as a tamper to knock the buildings down. When I first saw this, I thought, man, wait a minute, Newton's third law, which I tried to drill in, you know, to the students, means that if there's a force down, there's an equal and opposite force up. So the force on the upper block is just as great, it's equal to the force down. Okay, now I know it's hard to believe, but that's Newton's third law. I could go through, it's a conservation momentum argument, finally. But the upper columns have thinner support columns, they're thinning out as they go up, plus the fire was heating. So what do you expect? Well, you expect the upper block to disintegrate first, not to remain intact, as they require in their paper. Okay, so let's look at the actual data. Slowed down, looking at the upper block here, North Tower. Is it remaining as an intact block, or is it disintegrating before your eyes here? It's disintegrating. It's gone. Okay, so much for the collapse of the towers. Complete and rapid. Easy to remember. Never happened before that way, you see. Partial collapse, yes, that's what we expect. Okay. Lack of air defenses, my point number two. And I'm going to need that, Jack, but okay, here we go. did that ever bother you like it does me now as I think about that? Wow, where were our airplanes defending our capital and New York City on 9/11? Associated Press points out the scrambling of fighter aircraft at the first sign of trouble. So when a jet goes off course, they scramble jets to accompany it, see what's wrong, help it if they can. In the year period before 9/11, fighters were scrambled 67 times. On 9/11, how many interceptions of those four jets did we have? As far as we know, zero. Okay, that's what they tell us. NORAD spokesman says the fighters routinely intercept aircraft. When planes are intercepted, they are handled with a graduated response. So they try to bring it down if it's really intercepted. I mean, you know, help it to land. Okay, here's a Russian commander-in-chief of the Russian Air Force. Generally, this is the day after 9/11. It is impossible to carry out an active terror on the scenario which was used in the USA yesterday. As soon as something like that happens here, I am reported about that right away, and in a minute, we are all up. In other words, what was going on? You know, I would like to know. So here's some data. You won't have time to digest all of this, I'm sure, but let me point out, first of all, it's United and American Airlines. Those are the two involved. After the first crash, which was 8:46, we suspected something. The second crash, 9:03, we knew something was wrong. The plane that was headed towards the Pentagon went off course at 8:46, and the crash on the Pentagon was 9:38. 52 minutes later. Folks, that is plenty of time. Why was not this plane intercepted? This is serious and suggests that there's somebody knowing what's going on. So let's see. Norma Mineta testified to the 9/11 Commission that he went down to the Presidential Emergency Operations Center. This is a bunker underneath the White House on 9/11 in the morning. Vice President Cheney was there and was in charge. Now we're going to quote. We're going to quote from Secretary Mineta. We have this on videotape, but the 9/11 Commission report did not include this in their report. Just like they didn't include the collapse of Building 7. So it's important, right? Okay, so pay attention. During the time the airplane was coming into the Pentagon, Secretary Mineta, there was a young man who would come in and say to the Vice President, the plane is 50 miles out. Plenty of time for interception. The plane is 30 miles out. Still enough time. When it got down to the plane is 10 miles out, the young man also said to the Vice President, do the orders still stand? Now, this is a conscientious young man. He's worried. These orders, I mean, he's concerned. Well, that's why he's asking. Do these orders still stand? And the Vice President turned and whipped his neck around and said, of course the orders still stand. Have you heard anything to the contrary? And about 3 minutes later, then there was the collision with the Pentagon, and hundreds of people lost their lives without any warning, according to April Gallup, who was in the Pentagon that morning and managed to survive. She was knocked out. My wife and I heard her speak in California, was that February? And she was there with her baby, by the way. It's an interesting story. I won't go into the detail, but she said there was no warning. And she wants to know why there was no alert. They knew, 50 miles out, plenty of time to alert them as well as to scramble a jet. Not only was there no interception, there was no warning to the people in the Pentagon. Now, why in the world wouldn't they tell the people there's something coming your way? Clear the building. You've got time. Yeah. 10, 15 minutes. Just get out of there. The FBI seized videotapes from nearby hotels and businesses minutes after the hit. Only certain things have been released. We would like to have those videos released. If there's nothing to hide, why hide it? Release the videos, please, so we can see what actually hit the Pentagon and what was going on that day. I won't go into a great deal of detail, except to say that what has been released does not show a plane. It shows just a nose cone that is too close to the ground if this were, in fact, a Boeing 757, according to the official story. Okay, President Putin said on the 15th, 4 days after 9/11, I ordered my intelligence to warn President Bush in the strongest terms before 9/11 that 25 terrorists were getting ready to attack the U.S., including important government buildings like the Pentagon. So again, where were our air defenses? You know, why we had that warning. 11 other countries warned of an imminent and major attack. There were war game exercises that day, which you can read about in the Journal of 9/11 Studies if you look up Joe Firmich's paper. He's a local man, I believe. At least he's from, his family's from this area. Okay, moving right along. By contrast, on 9/10, the day before, FEMA had personnel in Manhattan. So let's read about this. This is Tom Kenny to Dan Rather, an interview on the 13th, so 2 days after 9/11. He said, as one of the first responders, we're currently one of the first teams that was deployed to support the city of New York in this disaster. We arrived on late Monday night, 9/10, and went right into action Tuesday morning, 9/11. Now that is efficiency, folks. That is efficiency. They were there the day before. Now think of, compare that with Katrina, how long it took FEMA to get there. Yeah? And we knew the hurricane was coming, right? It's not like, but here, supposedly, there was no foreknowledge, and yet, they were there in Manhattan, close by, the day before. Giuliani points out in his testimony to the 9/11 Commission that did not make the report, so pay attention, this is important, The reason Pier 92 was selected as command center was on the next day, on September 12th, Pier 92 was going to have a drill. But they, remember, they came on the 10th, getting ready for this drill planned for the 12th, you see? It had hundreds of people there from FEMA and so on. They were getting ready for a drill for biochemical attack, so that was going to be the place they were going to have the drill. The equipment was already there on the 11th, and the people. Remarkable. I think we deserve some answers, how they knew about that. Okay, I quoted President Peck. I moved that up. Okay, because again, I want to put that in context, you know, and let's bring it back again. Warning that for us, in our generation, there will be these secret combinations, which, by the way, not just mobs, because as Moroni talks about, they seek to take away the freedom of all the countries in the world. This is a big operation, and as outlined by Joel Skousen. Okay, the dust. World Trade Center dust, you've seen it, I'm sure. It was actually very toxic and loaded with melted spheres. This gets into some research I've been doing lately. Isaiah said, "The truth will whisper from the dust." And indeed, that dust does carry a lot of information to it. It was immediately found out by scientists that the dust was extremely alkaline and toxic. With a pH, I'm quoting now Greg Swayze, that some of it was as caustic as liquid drain cleaner. It's not something you want to breathe in or tell people it's safe, right? No. These results were sent to officials at EPA. Then in 2003, there came out a report, quoting now from the Associated Press, "The White House convinced EPA to add reassuring statements and delete cautionary ones, according to a report issued by EPA Inspector General Nikki Tinsley." Do you think she kept her job after this? No, she lost her job. At the White House's direction, the Environmental Protection Agency gave New Yorkers misleading assurances that there was no health risk. I'm starting to get a little ticked, you know, come on. This is, we know it's dangerous. In science, that's called data falsification. In everyday life, it's called lying. When you tell people it's safe, when in fact it's like liquid drain cleaner. Come on, these are people. We care for people, don't we? More than corporations and the Wall Street, you know, they told them, go back to work in the financial industry. It's safe, don't worry about it. Well, it's not safe. We can clean it up, but, you know, let's tell the truth. Okay. Now, of course, there are thousands who are sick and lawsuits to help care for those who are hurt by this because medical money has been refused these people because they said, well, it was safe, you know, but now, of course, we know it's not safe and so on. Okay, now another topic. Take a deep breath. Wake up. This, you may remember from last year, there were fires in some churches in Alabama. The investigators searched for the use of accelerants, chemicals that would accelerate the fires, to get them started, for example. Yeah. So, in fact, according to several news reports, they did find an accelerant called thermite, which proves that there was arson when you find an accelerant like that. Doesn't mean you know who did it yet, but you know there was a crime committed when you find accelerant. The Guide for Fire and Explosion Investigations, NFPA 921, states, "Unusual residues might remain from the initial fuel. Those residues could arise from thermite, etc." We're heading on into thermite here, discussion. This is standard. And if we find, which we have, traces of thermite, then we know that a crime was committed and we need a trial. Now, thermite is a highly energetic reaction that involves aluminum powder and iron oxide. On the left, you see a reaction that I did myself. You see the white smoke drifting away. If you get some of my videos are available online, you'll see this in motion. But the point is, there's also the same appearing molten metal pouring out of the South Tower just minutes before its collapse. This is discussed in my most recent paper in the Journal of 9/11studies.com. I don't have time to go into that in great detail here, but you can look it up there. In recent years, quoting, the use of thermite reactions as incendiary devices has gained popularity with arsonists because they are easily ignited, burn quickly, and can generate a very intense heat in excess of 4,000 Fahrenheit. They produce a characteristic burn pattern and leave behind evidence. These compounds are rather unique in their chemical composition. So here is the chemical signature for thermite. Don't expect you to memorize this, but on the left you see an X-ray energy dispersive spectrograph. That will be on the exam, by the way. So make note of that. You see Fe, a peak. Now, when there's a peak, that means this element is present. Fe is? Good, iron. You see Cu, it's fairly small, but that's copper. You see Al. Here, right? And then sulfur. And these are the characteristics of thermite with sulfur added. Sulfur makes the thermite, the hot molten iron, cut through steel faster. So that's what you expect if there's thermite. That's the signature you look for. It's basically iron, aluminum. That's the combination. And, you know, a fair amount of aluminum, you know, several percent. Okay, in the dust of the World Trade Center, I have a photo micrograph, which I took through, is a photo through a microscope, optical, on your right, and Jeanette McKinley, who provided a sample of the World Trade Center dust on the left. She's a survivor. Basically, her apartment was about 100 meters away from the South Tower. When the South Tower collapsed, the windows on her apartment broke in, and her apartment was flooded with dust. And she collected some of that. She said she had a spiritual sense that she should collect some of that dust. And it's a good thing she did. There's a great deal of information coming to us from these spheres that we see in the dust. You see the spheres there optically. When you look under a microscope, they still look like spheres on your right there. And here is the pattern that we observe for this sphere from the dust. Iron, aluminum, sulfur, and some copper. Now you say, well, how did I get so close in the other one? Let's see, let's compare. Here are the two compare. Can you tell which one is the World Trade Center dust and which one is the thermite? They're very close. There are some differences. Now, the reason the thermite is so close, you can tell they're different, though. I'll tell you the key. March 7th is when we, if you were paying attention to the dates, you have to be a good scientist, is when we analyzed the World Trade Center dust sphere and saw this signature. On the right, this was thermite that March 15th, 8 days later. So what I did is designed the thermite trying to match what I saw in the World Trade Center dust, and I did pretty well. I think you'd agree. Not perfectly. Here's the formula I actually used, and I do want to point out that even though you can buy thermite on eBay, it's still dangerous stuff. I wouldn't recommend it. So when you fire this thermite off, you do get tiny spheres. And what happens is the sparks that go into the air, the molten iron and aluminum, there's some captured in there. Because it's molten, the metal is pulled into a spherical shape, and that's because of surface tension. So you get that spherical shape. And we see this in the dust, just thousands, millions of these spheres finally. And in thermite, you also get the spheres as well as flow. And of course, we saw the flow out of the South Tower, that molten metal, which I argue in my paper is also very strong evidence for thermite. An independent laboratory at Worcester Polytechnic Institute in Massachusetts took some both World Trade Center 7 steel and Tower steel, and they show what they found when they looked inside. Now, they looked in a region where there was a high-temperature corrosion attack on the steel. They were puzzled by this, and look what they find in there. Sulfur, large amounts of sulfur. Now, this is not supposed to be in steel because it weakens steel. It also makes it melt at lower temperature. They report the severe corrosion and subsequent erosion of these samples are a very unusual event. These are fire engineering experts, material scientists. No clear explanation for the source of the sulfur has been identified. Well, we think we found it. It's the sulfur added to the thermite. And we're doing experiments to test that and to verify that. We'll leave it at that. We also looked at the World Trade Center concrete. We crushed it and did not see any iron-rich spheres in the concrete. You know, somehow they are released in the process. Cornell University, I sent a sample of this dust to them. Independent analysis, they confirmed significant iron and aluminum. That's where the apartment was. USGS and others, the Geological Survey, report the existence of iron-rich spheres in the dust. I called the fellow who was in charge of this project. I said, "Surely you saw those iron-rich spheres. Where in the world do you think they came from?" And he said, "Well, you know, I'm not real sure, but maybe when they were cutting the steel during cleanup, that would produce some spheres, yes. And somehow those got to large distances. I mean, we're, you know, 10, 15 blocks away." In addition, of course, the steel spheres, we did some of that with an oxyacetylene torch as a test. Those spheres do not show high aluminum, nor high sulfur, you know, because that would not be a strong steel if you did that. R.J. Lee report also reports spherical iron particles. So there's abundant evidence. How do you form, just in the face of it, these spheres require extremely high temperatures, around 2800 Fahrenheit to form. What's the temperature you can reach with thermite, typically?
4,000.
4,000, good, you guys are a sharp group. R.J. Lee reports finding, this is something we hadn't noticed in our studies, evaporated lead coating on dust fibers, and they comment the presence of lead oxide on the surface of mineral wool. There's a lot of mineral wool in the buildings. It's used for insulation, among other things. Indicates the existence of extremely high temperatures, over 3,000 Fahrenheit. Folks, you just cannot get anywhere near there with burning office materials. If you did, your, you know, wood and paper and kerosene, jet fuel is a form of kerosene. I have a kerosene stove, too. It's steel. It's not going to melt on me, you know. Okay. So you can't get anywhere near it. So how do they explain these high temperatures? Well, they don't. They just report that there's this lead. Well, how do we explain it? Thermite reactions give you those high temperatures. Probably other explosives in the building as well. There's reasons for that statement. But anyway, it's not just thermite I'm talking about here. But we have the evidence for thermite. We feel that we need, therefore, to have, we have basis to demand, really, a criminal investigation and a trial to see who put the thermite in these buildings. Okay, I'm going to go to the next topic now. This is close to the end. Hang on there. Billions estimated made on put options. Now, what's a put option? It's an opportunity in the stock market to make money when a stock goes down. If you think that it's pulling one out of the air, that American Airlines is going to go down in their stock value, then you would buy a put, and if it goes down, you make money. It's betting it'll go down. That's a put option. So quoting from Bloomberg, well, by the way, which are the two airlines that were involved? American and United. Trading in so-called put options, which rise in value when stock prices fall, surged as much as 285 times the previous average volume in American and United during the days before September 11th. Slightly suspicious again, huh? It's like FEMA being there the day before. I mean, these guys, though, are greedy. Ooh. Okay, Don Rattelauer says, this is, okay. No similar trading in other airlines occurred on the Chicago Exchange in the days immediately preceding Black Tuesday. Not only do they know that there's something happening, I've looked at the data, by the way. It's just about the five trading days before 9/11, it suddenly goes way up and then back down. And then, of course, they made a lot of money on these sports because, sure enough, United and American went down, way down after the attacks. Jack Manette talks about this in his book. BBC, American authorities are investigating unusually large numbers of shares in these airlines, United and American. Insurance companies also, specifically those which insure the WTC, Munich Re in particular, and Arms, which is a German company. Detail. Arms manufacturers, those went up, you know, right? The arms stocks went up after 9/11. They believe the sales were, this is not put options, right? Arms, okay. They believe the sales were by people who knew about the impending disaster, a fairly obvious conclusion. Bloomberg News, this would be the most extraordinary coincidence in the history of mankind if it was a coincidence. This could very well be insider trading at the worst, most horrific, most evil use you've ever seen in your entire life. It's absolutely unprecedented, and we would like to get to the bottom of it, right? Yes. Andreas van Bulow estimated the worldwide amount for these trades at $15 billion. Okay, 9/11 Commission report does include this. It's a little hard to escape because it was so obvious, and it was in the media so extensively. In a footnote on page 499, we read, highly publicized allegations of insider trading in advance of 9/11 generally rest on reports of unusual pre-9/11 trading activity in companies whose stocks plummeted after the attacks. Right? Some unusual trading did, in fact, occur. Okay, grant that. But each such trade proved to have an innocuous explanation, with no conceivable ties to Al-Qaeda. What's the matter? It's not Al-Qaeda. Go away. It's okay. Let them make some money. Now, are you happy with that? Is this blinders on Al-Qaeda only? I mean, look, the Book of Mormon tells us there were terrorists out there in the wilderness, right? But there are also Gadians in the management of the government, right? Okay, so we should be clued in that we're not going to be happy just to say, well, it's not Al-Qaeda, let them make some money. Come on, I want to know the names of these people that made this money and what they knew and how they knew it, and let's get this going. So I just remind you that the scientific method takes all the facts and then you try to draw conclusions from them. Another method, in this cartoon called the political method, you start with a conclusion, Al-Qaeda did it, the Muslims did it, and then you only look at those facts that support your conclusion. Anything else is innocuous, I guess. This question comes up quite often. We're getting really close to the end now. Was my paper peer-reviewed? The paper, and I'll just answer that because that came up just yesterday again. So I'm really concerned about that. The paper was, this is the paper that came out in November of 2005. You may some of you saw it. It was in Deseret News front page. I was quite surprised they did that, but they did. It said, professor predicts, or says, bombs, not planes, bought down the towers, something like that. Well, I wouldn't use the term bombs. I would use the term cutter charges, but, you know, okay, that was close enough. The paper was peer-reviewed. I wouldn't have published it without that. And it was accepted for an Elsevier publication in October. And it was put online with the permission of the editor in November. Now, someone noted the editor supported Marxist studies and objected to the venue for my paper. And some still think my paper is published with Professor Ruzremka. It's not. Here's what actually happened. A solution, so this is a bit of a crisis because there's a lot of pressure for me to just pull my paper. Oh, you can't publish with this guy, he's a Marxist. Or at least he teaches Marxism at the University in New York State. Professor David Ray Griffin, who's written a number of books about 9/11, excellent works, in my opinion, he suggested a trade, this is with me and Professor Ruzremka. I would submit my paper to a volume that he and Professor Scott were putting together and editing, and he would replace my paper with one of his own, an essay that he was working on. And that was agreed on, and I thought all parties were satisfied with that agreement. Seems so, and we went that way for months. However, the paper would have to undergo another round of stiff peer reviews, which was the case. And peer reviews, that means other PhDs looking at your paper and critiquing it, roughly stated. That process goes back to the time of Isaac Newton and is very effective in science. These are anonymous peer reviewers in general. If they weren't anonymous, then the peer review process would tend to break down. You say, well, you let Joe Blow read my paper. I know he won't like it. You know, so it has to be anonymous, and that's understood. In general, it's kept that way. But Professor Griffin stated there were 4 peer reviewers for my paper this second time around. 2, all of them PhDs, and 2 of them were physicists. And this is where my paper was published, 9/11, An American Empire, Intellectuals Speak Out. Griffin, by the way, was invited by, I can't remember his name. But anyway, he's spoken here at BYU. He's quite a well-known fellow. Okay. I want to say something about the publication. There was a tremendous effort to get this paper pulled off the internet, not published, and so on. For example, emails from a contractor who claimed Homeland Security contacts said, the publication of this article can be stopped, and I have the contacts necessary. Have the contacts to make this happen. This is just days after my paper was online and the Des News article. You need to give this very serious consideration, he wrote to me and others at the university. This is an issue that is more important than any individual career. I believe he was referring to my career. I corresponded with him on some technical points and came out pretty good, as he admitted in the exchange. He said, I have learned to appreciate the value of silence, even in the case of superior data and information. Now this to me, a little obvious. He said, as painful, and he wanted me to pull my paper, as painful as it may seem now, perhaps it may be less painful than could occur after publication. About 2 weeks after publication, then I was put on leave, and I just want to point out there's a lot of pressure. I don't fault the university. They offered me actually a very, fair, I believe, package for early retirement. I was not fired. I was offered early retirement. Now, if you want to read more about these topics, which I can't possibly cover in this short time, please go to this journal. Here's some of the authors in the Journal of 9/11 Studies. Wish I could introduce them to you, but you'll have to go to the journal there yourself to meet these folks. Scholars from all over the world now. Two of those shown here from Canada, for example. We are submitting papers now to what's called Tier 1, Tier 2 journals. My first paper called for an investigation. It's not something you would expect to find in Scientific American. But now we have research data, and so I and others are submitting research results to these publications. I just show you, I published in Nature, Carol went through these, and Physical Review Letters published in Scientific American with Professor Rafalski, published in Nature. These results were confirmed, cold fusion. Wish I had time to tell you about that. That's my other life, And solar cooking is my other life. Okay. Conclusions. Yes, I'm going to skip that because I want to talk about what we can do instead. The conclusions, we've already been through that. Freshen your mind. There is this international 9/11 truth movement. It is growing, as you can see, from the group assembled here. And we can hand out literature. Point to Jack Manette's book, The Journal of 9/11 Studies, online, and so on. Please take courage. As Elder Packer pointed out, this is a time where we need inspiration, and as we have that, we can, together, we can make it through. And courage is, and love, you see, are the watchwords. Who said this? The Book of Mormon narrative is a chronicle of nations long since gone, but in its descriptions of the problems of today's society, it is as current as the morning newspaper. President Hinckley. Now, It talks about secret combinations over and over in this book, you know. You can't miss it. You can if you really try. But, okay. President McKay said, "We commend and encourage every person and group who is sincerely seeking to study constitutional principles and awaken a sleeping and apathetic people to the alarming conditions that are rapidly advancing about us." Rally around the Constitution, one of my favorite themes. North American Union, if you don't know about that, Google on it. What can we do? Rotating 3-month food supply. One, this my second one. That's in the New Church pamphlet where you have 3-month supply and you're actually using that and replenishing it. So you always have a 3-month supply. I think that's a great idea. I think a lot of people aren't seeing it, but you get the pamphlet. It's right there. Along with the year supply. Solar cookers, fitness. I was glad Joel mentioned that. I'll take note of that, Joel. I'm working on that tomorrow. Gardens, resourcefulness, faith, and love. This picture of me with a solar cooker, that would be me on your right there. I've given out hundreds of these to people all over the world in developing countries, these solar cookers. And it's a good thing for us to have a way to cook, you see, if the electricity should go out, for example. The end is getting closer, and this is little Einstein here. I'll finish with Joseph Smith. "It is an imperative duty we owe to all the rising generation. Therefore, we should waste and wear out our lives in bringing to light all the hidden things of darkness." Thank you.